So hi everybody, welcome along to our class. And for those of you online, welcome. So let's begin as we normally do by, we're going to do a meditation first, breathing and calming meditation. We will set our motivation, do a visualization and take reference together, and then we'll begin the class. So adjust your posture till you do feel quite comfortable. Check that your back is straight, your shoulders are nice and relaxed. You keep your eyes open or close them. And you can place your hands wherever you like. And when you've done that, allow the body to breathe itself. And become aware of the movements the body is making when you inhale or exhale the breath. Focus your attention on those movements and the feelings associated with them. By doing this, your mind becomes focused and your body relaxes. And being in a relaxed state of mind, it's very easy to imagine the appearance of the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas above you. And that you're surrounded by all sentient beings. Think that you're in the company of all these beings, and beneath the arc of the enlightened beings, because you wish to lead everybody who surrounds you towards enlightenment. You want to help them put an end to their suffering and the causes of suffering, and to have them develop all of the good qualities of mind whereby they can effortlessly benefit themselves and everyone else. I think we are going to go to refuge for the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, to attain enlightenment for the benefit of others. And you recite with me, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. In response to this wish, lights and nectars pour from the heart of the Buddha. They wash over you and over the beings surrounding you. Any and all obstacles containing a state of genuine refuge are washed away. The mind is filled with devotion to the three jewels. Four immeasurable thoughts come to mind, and you recite them. May all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. I think I'm going to develop these four thoughts myself. I'm going to help everybody else do the same. And in response to this wish, and with your acknowledgement of the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas above you, you decide to prostrate yourself with your body, speech, and mind, make offerings and confess to the field of enlightenment. You say, reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of psychic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and other spirits to the great enlightenment. It is stop any clinging that we might have to our merit, to ourselves as a person taking refuge in the goals we seek. We recollect the wisdom and realize the emptiness. We transform everything into its empty nature. It reappears as the universe itself, and we offer this to the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas. We say, this ground, anointed with perfume, stirring with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents of sun and moon. I imagine this is what a field of offer. May all living beings enjoy this feeling. Idam Guru Rata Mandala Kamaryatayam. So the Mandala has been released. The Buddha accepts it and he smiles at us. And we look up into his face and into his eyes. We see compassion and mercy and acceptance, and we feel at ease. Then the emanation of the Buddha leaves his heart, moves through space, and comes to abide above the crown of your head, facing in the same direction you are. The emanation begins to descend, it enters the crown of your head, comes down through your body, and comes to rest at the level of your heart. Radiance of the emanation begins to expand and fills your body and mind with light. The light goes out through the pores of your skin and begins to fill the 10 directions of space. And wherever there are sentient beings within space, they are absorbed by that light and utterly transformed into a fully awakened state. Then from the 10 directions of space, the light returns and re-enters your heart. You can feel yourself breathing normally and naturally, and you know you're sitting in a seat. And you also acknowledge that this meditation is done on the level of imagination. And even so, it has imprinted the mind with the effort you've put into this meditation. So you put into your mind a cause for enlightenment. So you accept that with a sense of joy. You think, well, I've really done something meaningful with my life today. Where you achieve enlightenment quickly for the benefit of others. And you breathe in through your nostrils. And exhale through your opening mouth. And allow your eyes to flutter open. And move your body in whichever way you like. So you're present and relaxed. So this is class 8. And this is the end of the sort of teachings. We've got a review coming up in a couple of weeks. But so far, we've looked at the causes for going for refuge. So I think, you know, in general, you say our life will certainly come to an end, and what will happen after it, we are unsure. So to head in the right direction, so to speak, we take refuge in the Buddha Dharma and Sangha to protect ourselves from future unfortunate rebirths, and so that our journey can continue and we can engage in a spiritual path in the best conditions. To help us do that, we take refuge in the three rare sublime ones, the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. And there are many, many benefits. Of course, we look at the benefits of taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. But in general, these benefits can't be measured. So it's useful to sort of have little lists and sort of look at them sometimes and familiarize your mind with them. said, "Ah, oh, this is a great benefit of going for refuge to the Buddha, to the Dharma, to the Sangha. And these are the qualities that these objects have." And if you've not taken refuge in the three jewels, then it's possible to do so. And we talked about that last week. We took up the refuge ceremony. And those who have already taken refuge, they can, because they re-strengthen the vows of approaching refuge. So you would have known, like last we talked about, there's in the refuge ceremony, there's a vow of becoming a Buddhist. That's the refuge vow. That's one. Then the vows of approaching refuge are offered.
Approaching virtue.
So we've got a refuge vow and the vows approaching virtues. And sometimes the teacher will give them, so they'll say all five at once, or you can take any of the five. And it's never certain how the teacher will do it. So I think if it is the case that the teacher says, okay, we're going to give all five at once. So if you take these vows, you take all five. And you are familiar with it because we've spoken of it, and you're going to go, wow, hang on, I don't know whether I can, you know, like I still drink alcohol and there's reasons for doing it. There could be vows that you're certain yourself, if I take this vow, I'm certain to break it. I won't be able to do it. So there's two ways you can look at this, I think. One is to sort of in your own mind decide, well, these are the ones I'm actually taking, and this is how I'm taking them. Yeah? So when he gives all this, you say, yeah, this, and you're going to go, okay, I'm doing this, not that, and this. And this is how I'm going to do them. That's what I'm taking. So you could do it that way. The other way you could possibly do it is to go, okay, he's going to give them all, but the purpose of taking vows is to renew them every day. It's not that you can hold them. So don't do this because they're given, and you go, I can't hold it, so I can't take it. That doesn't work that way. They give them, you know yourself, sometimes you won't be able to hold it. The thing is to pick it back up again. That's the point of the vow, not that I can't do it.
And there's also the other option, that story of there was a butcher who wanted to take the vows, and so then he couldn't take the first vow. So the preceptor said, well, it'll be more beneficial if you take the vow, and at least in the night time you're not a butcher. So then at least half the time you're holding the vow. Mm. So there's...
And the other thing, the worst thing you could probably do is go, well, I can't take it then. You just take the refuge vow and don't do any of the other approaches of virtue. Yeah, so you have this refuge ceremony and you'll have to sort of listen carefully and decide what you want to do. And here's the good point that Biffy brought up here, is that the butcher took the vow, and of course, in his future lives, he had this peculiar sort of life too, didn't he? I think, the Bardo state was like half of the time was tremendous freaking out, suffering, and half of the time was just wonderful bliss. Outcome, what a peculiar life. Vow was this vow. Yeah. Like I said, the essence of vows is to retake them. Like each day you take refuge, right? So this is the thing that you engage in the four or five paths. So, it's no problem.
Because it's a skillful means of getting us to
closer to be a virtuous
change
person.
Our behavior. Yeah,
that's it. Yeah.
We're not perfect straight away.
No, no.
We'll give up. If we just have to be perfect. Straight.
And if we wait until we're perfect before we take the vow, there's no point in having the vow, is there? I mean,
yeah. That's right.
So today we're going to have a look at some of the things we should consider before taking refuge, on top of what we've studied. So these are the preliminaries for refuge. And here I'm going to do it from a different sort of perspective. And this is how they often teach it using the Kagyu Lam Rim. So the author of that was a great scholar called Gampopa. And the way they do it is they start off by considering that any being with a mind has the potential to become awakened, has the potential to become a Buddha. So we have a mind, so we have the potential to become a Buddha. And that is called the primary cause. Without that cause, no real point in having a go at it. Then the support or the condition, the best condition you can have to support that cause is to have a rebirth as a human being, as a leisure, an opportunity to practice. The contributory cause is the teacher. So we have the seed for enlightenment, we possess that as having a mind. We need these other good conditions. So we start to be a human being, with leisure and opportunity, and have that supported by a teacher. And then there are the different methods of practice, and one of them, of course, is recollection of death. Recollection of death is tremendously useful because it's one of the most powerful things you could recollect in terms of the Buddha's teachings. In fact, the Buddha himself said, of all my teachings I've given, two have the most power. And one is the recollection of death, and the other is the wisdom and realize of emptiness. So we'll talk about these, and also finish off by looking at what is the measure of having gone for refuge. So you actually know, I'm a refugee. I have taken refuge. I am going for refuge. But sometimes if you sort of ask you, like say, so have you gone for refuge? You go, yeah. So what's that mean? What are you actually doing? You say, well, I've taken refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. You go, yes, well, lots of people have done that, but are you actually going for refuge? And then it's like, I'm not quite sure what you mean. So there's got to be some way where you know yourself, yes, I'm going for reference to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, but what am I doing after that? Because like Geshe-la said, when you take refuge, that's just the start. What are we actually doing? How are we engaging in the practice of being a refugee from cyclic existence? So, of course, again, the texts haven't changed. I'll be basing my classes on this material. And I'll start off by saying what Lama Yeshe said, which was, Westerners, that's us, should understand that taking refuge is a state of mind. So one of the things I was going to say, like, if you didn't have a mind, what would you be called?
Dead.
Yep, dead.
Inanimate?
A corpse. Now, when you're dead or a corpse, do you feel anything? No.
No.
Do you suffer at all? Mm-hmm. No. It's only when you have a mind there, isn't it? Is a corpse happy? No. That's not, it's just inanimate, right? But as soon as there's a mind in that body, it's no longer a corpse, and now it can experience suffering or happiness. So that's where your refuge is, mind. Because without one, you don't feel anything. You don't experience anything. As soon as you've got one, everything happens. So you've got to sort of decide, do I want more suffering or less? Do I want to be happy or happier? Yeah. And having this mind, what's its potential? So this is what I take from this. It's like, what are you doing? What am I doing with the mind when I am practicing refuge? Something to think about that. Is that determines? So then, okay, so what's this thing called mind? What is this thing that has the potential to fully awaken and become the mind and the body of a Buddha? So we need to define this phenomenon. There's something called clear and knowing. So the knowing is the function of the mind, and the clear is referring to its nature. And there's lots of sort of different ways you can talk about it. So sometimes they talk about the mind as, you know, the phenomena that has an object. But it's the subject, right? Mind is the subject. But subjects only exist independent upon objects. If you don't have objects, you can't have subjects because they're dependent, there's a dependent relationship there. So it's that which has the object, or the subject of experience. Another one, it's a little bit dry. This is, the mind is the subjective event that arises in dependence on the object that appears to it. So mind is a process, it's a verb, it's not a noun. So we often think of it as like noun, don't we? So it's a thing that we name it, called this thing called mind, but it's not. So now I've got a book downstairs I read, and this teacher also, he talks about the mind, and he, you know, I mean, this is a conceptual understanding of what we've just said. He's got a way of making it really experiential. So he asks you whether you have a mind or not. Everybody says, of course, yes. And he says, where is it? And straight away, nothing like that, everyone's going, I kind of know what to say. Huh? So he says, oh, when I ask these questions of the Tibetans, I always say, oh, it's here in my heart. But when I talk to the Chinese, they say it's here in my head. That probably most Westerners might too.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then he says, you know, what I do is, he says, I get them to like stand on something sharp. And then immediately says, well, the mind is in my foot. So like, you can't, like you said once again, you say, well, if it's anywhere, like how do you know it's there?
You can't have a where with something that's not physical.
That's right. So it tells you straight off, it's not a physical phenomenon. It doesn't have any shape, doesn't have any colour. It's mostly all you can say is that what it's not. But there are some things we can say about its properties, and one of them is knowing. It's not like space that doesn't know, it knows. It knows there's a pain in my foot, it knows I'm mentally distressed. And so that's the activity of mind, is to know. But it's also this other part called the clarity, which is quite interesting too. So that's what I mean by the entity of consciousness. So like I said, not a thing, it's a verb, it's a completely change. It never stable for a moment.
Sandy says, could you please repeat the sentence, the mind is the subjective event.
Yep, the subjective event that arises in dependence, so independence, on the object that appears to it. So now, as they say that, this is relating to the clarity aspect, the reflective capacity of the mind. And a simple way of thinking about this is, if you just put up a mirror and you're not in front of it, right? You do not appear on the surface of the mirror, do you? You're not reflected in the mirror. You can look at the mirror, but you're not in front of it, right? You won't appear in the mirror, will you? But everything else that's in front of that mirror will appear in front of it. As soon as you move far enough so that your reflection appears in the mirror, that's the reflective capacity of the mirror. And you move out of it, it's gone again, isn't it? Well, think about your mind like that. It's not that like we are, like the objects you see in front of it, we're not in your mind, are they? But I'm not in your mind, right? I'm over here. Right? Don't think I am. If you did, it's like, whoa. Right? So I'm over here, but I'm appearing to you. And you can actually turn away from me, so you didn't see me at all, but you can still think about me, and I would appear to you. That's the reflective capacity. And non-physical. So it has the capacity of reflection and has no physical
characteristics.
And like I said, it's not like a thing because it's
not, so it's not static. Mind it's not is static. Not static.
It's not a static thing. So every moment of mind that's produced is disintegrating as it's produced, because the mind changes.
So what's the organizing factor in the mind then?
are the mental factors, factors of mind. But here we're just talking about the entity of mind.
Mm-hmm.
So organizing in discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
Contact with an object, all these sort of things. So they're all mental factors. So it's quite interesting to think about this, especially when you use the analogy of the mirror or like space. So with space, you know, the things that appear in space, they don't stay in space, do they? They go, like if you think about a plane, it doesn't sit up there, it just goes through space and it's gone, the space just remains. If clouds appear in space, they just disintegrate back into space. So the space always remains, but the objects come and go. And when we talk about the capacity of water, water also has this reflective capacity. So you can put something up and reflect in the water, but it's not in the water. The water always just remains as water. Now think about this in terms of your own disturbing emotions. You talk about them as if they're like in the mind. But again, you could ask yourself, well, where in the mind could that be? So here we've got meanings of clear, non-physical, non-obstructing, reflective, and empty. Like I said, there's nothing about the space of the space around us, right? It's empty, and you can put things in it, but then you can take them out, and it doesn't do anything to the space. It obstructs it for a few moments, but the space is always there. If it weren't there, the object couldn't be in the space, couldn't occupy the space. The empty here is also referring to just that, but also having no intrinsic nature. Not truly existing, existing in mere name, and being a dependent arising. Because each moment of mind depends upon its previous moments, and the moment of mind experiencing now creates the next one. To create the next one, it has to disintegrate. It's quite an interesting phenomenon, isn't it, mind, when you start to think about it. And this is a phenomenon that we, has the experiences of suffering or happiness. But the something what we call suffering or happiness, they're not inherent to the mind.
So the Buddha also has mind.
Yeah, the Buddha has mind. That's right. And this mind that we presently have could, with the sort of work we could do, become the mind of the Buddha. At the present, it's the mind of a sentient being. But yeah, at death, we could end up having the mind of an animal. Because the nature always stays the same. It's never ever physical. It's always got the reflective capacity. The animal, a dog, for instance, knows a bone. No, so it's still got the knowing capacity. That always stays the same. I mean, the thing of phenomenon of knowing is always there. The phenomenon of always being non-physical, it always stays the same. So sometimes in the Kagyu tradition, they call that mind permanent. Because from the political perspective, they understand that. They know you're not talking about something that,
fixed.
Yeah. So this is, it's upon this mind that liberation is possible. And why is that? Because it says here the basis is pure. So what's that like? In other words, this is like the idea of the surface of the mirror or the nature of the water. So water, as you all know, can become dirty. But actually you can sift the water, the dirt out of the water, and the water is just, there's this clarity again. The dirt temporarily obscures the water, but we can pull the dirt out and there's the nature of water again, clear again. Same with the mirror. Like, if you put a lot of images up in front of the mirror, well, it can obscure other images. Right, so for instance, Bev and I are both looking in the mirror, and I stand behind Beverly. Well, I'm not going to see myself in the mirror, right? Because her appearance obscures mine. But whatever goes in front of that mirror, it really doesn't do anything to the mirror, does it? Because the mirror just always retains its ability to reflect. Whether it's horrible images or really pleasant images, nothing like that. But then sometimes you don't see the images clearly because the dust that settles on the surface of the mirror. But then you can remove the dust and the reflective capacity is always there. So this is like the mind. So sometimes it can experience a great deal of suffering and you think you know, it's so much you might want to kill yourself, right? It's so terrible. But then suppose you don't kill yourself, then maybe a year later you're happily married and you won the lotto. That can happen. And suddenly, like, where did all that suffering go? There's always just appearances. And we think they're more than that. That's where we get into trouble. But that mind, that clarity is always like pure. It just stays the same. So the basis, it's always like that. So all these objects can appear in the mind of the Buddha, but because he's got no afflictions also there, no problems. Everything seems very clearly. But for people like ourselves, like you and I might be appearing in front of each other, but we might be thinking about something terrible that's happened. Right? And it's sort of, it's there, it's obscuring our sense of directly engaging with one another. And these afflictions are adventitious, meaning that the difficult problems that you've experienced in your life don't just stay there. So like I say, many of us have had difficult lives and experiences that seem terrible, and then 5 years to 10 years later, you can't even remember what it was about. And so like I said, so it was there then, but it's not there now. And the afflictions are also dependent, just like the mind is. So the afflictions sort of like come and go, which means they haven't penetrated this purity of the mind. They're not always there.
In fact, they're of a different nature altogether.
That's right, different nature altogether. Just like the dirt is a different nature to the water, the plane is a different nature to the space around it. And so not only that, it's really possible to cultivate your powerful antidotes. There have been times in our lives where we thought something was true, and then later on discovered it wasn't. and what we thought was true, we don't hold that idea anymore. So it's quite possible to cultivate these powerful antidotes. In fact, I remember a story during the 60s when the black march on Alabama. So, and a lot of white people and black people all got together and marched down to Selma. And so of course they were attacked by the Ku Klux Klan and all the racists and everything. And so these, before they did that march, they were taught how to behave, right, which is not to fight back. And so what happened, of course, was they were attacked and they were beaten. One of the people who beat the marchers up was so surprised that they didn't strike back. He had to ask him, like, why? And when the black person explained, the Negro person explained, this fellow changed his mind. So that was the end of his racism. He had this particular idea about what it meant to be a black person and they needed to be beaten and all that stuff. But after that conversation, in fact, it was a number of conversations. In fact, this black man convinced the leader of the Ku Klux Klan to abandon the Klan. There's a whole lot of people that he did this with. he had to have a conversation. There's all these conversations. And so this racism that he had, not just him, but a number of different people. Right? They just, this afflictive mental states were dropped and they never went back there. So this liberation, like it's possible, just because of the nature of the mind. Of course, we have to work with our nature. So it's going to happen all by itself. So transformation can actually take place. And if we ask ourselves why, it's because it's clear and cognizant nature of the mind is a stable basis for the cultivation of all excellent qualities. It's like, you know, I said before about the metaphor of space, you know, it's like all these objects can appear in space. You can throw balls up, you can throw feathers up, you can have planes fly, you can have rockets, you can have people fall through space, all sorts of things like that. That's this open nature. And so in that open nature, all good qualities can be developed, and all bad ones too. But with the bad ones, they're not stable because they're adventitious, they can be overcome through reasoning. Whereas the good ones can be held in that space. You can use that space to develop them. Which leads to this the habituation to good qualities is possible. And if you look at like His Holiness, when he was born and became that little boy, the person he is today is a very different person than that little boy, isn't it? I mean, not just in his physical shape, but in what he knows. So it's like 80-odd years of mind training. So this transformation, the habituation of good qualities is possible. And as you, I'm certain it's the same with all of you, like, you might have been a little tear away when you were a kid.
Tear away?
And you might find nice, good teachers or somebody who you respected, and you changed. Or, like Deb, you were telling me, right? So when Deb was also a bit anxious about getting on planes and going to the airport, but then you know you have these conversations with people, and you find out you can do it. So yeah, and once you've done it, you can habituate your mind to that process of going, well, I will be going overseas again and I will be taking planes again. I want to keep using that method because that worked for me. Right, so you can habituate the mind to good qualities. And lastly, wisdom enhances qualities where it actually destroys the afflictions because the afflictions can't stand up to wisdom. Mm-hmm. Good qualities are supported by wisdom. They never diminish by wisdom. Now, when this, so all of this means that we have the potential, or the mind has this nature that can be transformed into the wisdom dharmakaya of a Buddha and the rupakayas of the Buddha. Meaning, in other words, the body and the mind of a Buddha. That's the potential the human mind has.
So this really just takes it away from hope or belief and shows, on like in a mind science way, why it's possible.
Yeah, it's, we don't have to require to believe it. It's just, you've got to sort of like think it through. And like they try and find faults, try and go, oh, yeah, what about this or what about that? It's fine. It's a good thing to do that. So when you have no doubts and are certain, then you can have you come across the teachings on death and impermanence and go, well, guess what? This opportunity you've got is running out. You want to get a move on. I mean, the nature of the mind stays the same, but you as the person who possesses that mind, you're not here forever. So they give these similes. So they said that, yeah, these are the nine similes.
Of
this nature that we have in the mind, the nature of the mind itself to attain Buddhahood. Yet it's like I say, like it's actually the Buddha in a decaying lotus, or honey amidst bees, which I think is a good one, because if you see, like, people have a look inside a hive and you look at the honey, right, what's in the honey?
Nectar.
No, bees. There's lots of bees in the honey, right? You don't have the hive, the beehive.
Yeah. It's, not in the honey, they're in the hive.
Yeah, they're in the hive, but they skewer the honey.
Oh, right, gotcha, yeah.
So to get to the honey, you've got to remove the bees.
Yes.
It's the same to us, like, you know, we have the honey of the mind, and the sweet mind, but there's the...
All these busy bees.
The busy bees going,
no, and our afflictions are biting us.
Yeah.
Which is a bit like that picture of all the skydivers, you know, like all busy bees in the mine.
The other leaves is one of is of gold being in filth. This is, if someone actually drops some gold in a pile of filthy refuse at the side of the road, we don't know it's there, let alone think to take it out, clean it and use it. Similarly, while our gold-like Buddha essence is not mixed with defilements, the filth of the manifest three poisons prevents us from seeing it. So we've got to remove the afflictions, and there is what was always there, shown to us. So you can get glimpses of this through meditation, and that's the point, right? To, like, you know, slow down and let the conceptions fall away. And you find there's something there already that we call mind. And also, you know, real good can come of it, or more badness. So Buddha nature is also talked about in Tantra, but there it's explained slightly differently. It is the subtlest mind wind that is empty of inherent existence and whose continuity goes on to awakening. So this is what they call a beginningless and endless mind. It ends in what we call full awakening, but it keeps going, right? Because Buddha's now, you can work effortlessly and spontaneously for all sentient beings, and before you couldn't. So each of us possesses this mind. This is, like I said, the most subtle mind that, you know, will go on, like we will die in this life, and this is what goes on, this very subtle winged mind.
They say this is the Dharmakaya, it's in the nature.
No, this is not the Dharmakaya.
No, okay.
There's the potential to be the Dharmakaya.
If one would become enlightened.
That's right, yeah. So Dharmakaya is to it, you know, the body of wisdom of a Buddha. So because this subtlest wind energy produces both samsara and nirvana.
Okay.
If you don't know its nature, it's samsara. You can't work with it, it's samsara. You can work with it, and you, because if you know its nature, nirvana, liberation. And so a lot of Buddhist practice is recognition of this, trying to get this in your own. In the Nyingma tradition, like you say, you can do it just because you've got a mind. It's present in every moment of wakefulness. In the other traditions, I say to do this, you've got to use higher psychotantra techniques. So that's why, you know, you've heard that saying, sentient beings are just Buddhas, but they are defiled by adventitious stains. When these are removed, they are Buddhas. His Holiness says, the first line, meaning sentient beings are just Buddhas, the first line indicates that sentient beings have the substantial cause for Buddhahood, the subtlest mind wind. It does not mean that sentient beings are Buddhas, because someone cannot be both a sentient being and a Buddha simultaneously. Now, it's not a bad thing. I mean, so when you come across somebody else and says, oh, sentient beings are Buddhas, you go, oh, explain. Please explain.
Well, sometimes people say that, oh, we're all enlightened already. It's just like some nice thought so, to have. But
yeah.
It's very clearly obvious. No.
Yeah, yeah. So His Holiness says that through the practice of special techniques in higher Sokotantra, the continuum of this subtlest mind wind can be purified and transformed into the three bodies of a Buddha. Like I said, like it can create samsara, so you need to purify the causes for that samsaric appearance. It can also bring about nirvana. And that's what the goal is here. So it can never be destroyed, it's beginningless and endless. And for us at the present, it's, you know, manifesting as samsara, but can also come to Buddhahood. Now, to actually transform this very selfless mind, we're in the very best position of all. We've got the human body and mind. And we're interested. We're interested. Some of us might have even found teachers that we could rely upon for a good explanation of it.
And we're here. And we're not here. Just interested, but we made it tonight.
Yeah, everybody's made an effort to actually sit down and come to this room, think about this material, and you've been doing it for a while. That's real good. So Nagarjuna said, for an animal to obtain birth as a human being is more difficult than for a blind turtle to put its head through a hole in a yolk adrift in the great ocean. So, make your life meaningful, O King, by practicing the holy teachings. This quote comes from a text called Nagarjuna's advice to his friend, the king. So the king, of course, in our ruling empire, calls across the best philosopher in the land and goes, come here for a chat. And the king tells him, you're so lucky. You've got this human body, you've got the mind, you're interested in Dharma, you're talking to me, but you've got to use it. Now, because this position is so rare. So in this metaphor, the vast ocean is samsara, and the sentient beings are the turtle. Most of them are blinded by ignorance. They do not understand cause and effect and cannot distinguish virtue from non-virtuous karma. Most of these sentient beings live in the lower realms at the bottom of the ocean of samsara. The turtle coming up to the surface once every 100 years represents the very rare chance for a sentient being to be born as a human or a god. But even more rare than that is the turtle's poking its head through the center of the golden yolk. The golden yolk represents the teachings of the Buddha, especially the complete highest Mahayana teachings, which include Sutra and Tantra. So what makes it very precious is to have the conditions, the favorable conditions, which include spare time. You've got spare time to develop your mind through the study and practice of Dharma. So when I was growing up, when I became interested in this, I read the book Siddhartha. So there were no Buddhists in New Zealand at the time, but no opportunity.
And no Dhamma centers.
And no Dharma centers there, and no one to explain it, so I actually understood Siddhartha wrongly and made a mistake. Then I came to Australia, I just got here, and Buddha Dharma arrived in New Zealand. And then it took me another 20 years being here, but actually find there's a centre just down the road, which is run by Buddha's mother. And after read Tibetan Book of Living and Dying by Sogyal Rinpoche, I was like, this is it. And straight after deciding this is it, really quickly, within 2 weeks, met a Buddhist monk, who took me to the centre, and I've never looked back since. And all of that was really, I only did that because of my partner's impending death. But now, if that had not been going on, it's highly likely I wouldn't have tried. Really, I wouldn't have even looked. So once we have this life we have with the leisure and opportunity to engage in Buddhist practice, we need to cultivate our understanding of Dharma. So here Lama Zopa Rinpoche says, we have this precious human body, qualified by the 8 freedoms and the 10 righteousnesses, in order to serve other living beings. So when I first read this, like I said, I nearly fell off my seat. Because I've gone on to the center, and the first teaching was on the Four Noble Truths, and Geshe was talking about emptiness, and I was like, wow, and he jumped out of my chair and went, that's it. Long last, I found what I'm looking for, you know. And then it was like letting the thing settle down, and coming up the other side, go to dependent arising. And then you go, okay, so what do you do with this wisdom? And what am I going to do with my life? You know, so I don't know. I'm going because you've got a life, you're living. What are you going to do? And then picked up Love is Life's book. That's what I said. It's like, yeah. Oh, yeah, I thought that when I was about 14. And sort of forgot, you know, couldn't work out how to do it. And then I still didn't know, so I had a survey of the sentient beings to go, yeah, how? But, you know, there's all these different ways you can do it. Which is the one that suits you? Which is the one that suits me? So there's a whole lot of things I just didn't want to do in terms of how to serve them. And then his mother asked me to teach. And that seems to help me. Yeah, so we've got to find a way we can serve other living beings. And it might be just that you look after your husband and your children with kindness and compassion and look after yourself too, and then gradually extend it out to help other people and you know, just sort of restrain yourself from hurting them anyway and do the best you can to help. And Geshe Potowa said, in order to obtain liberation, there is nothing more important than the teacher. Although you may be able to do the activities of this life by watching others, without a teacher, you are not doing well. How can someone who has just arrived from the bad migrations get to a place they've never been without a guide?
Like we're all arriving from the bad lands.
That's right.
And then
we want to change our behavior.
Then we're like the blind turtle. We're still blind. We still don't know where we're going. We've heard, you know, a promise of some kind of liberation. But
we've gone into the bad towns. We're in town. We've been elected with the sheriff and the mayor, and we don't quite know how to do it. Mm. We've still got the idea of corruption. Taking something for myself. So we need someone to help us. And a living being. So a book is not enough. Okay. So I remember thinking about this and thinking, I need to actually see if there's any human beings doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's, you know, you can come across many religious texts and agree. And when you do, it's like, yeah, but who's doing it?
And also because you can read a book and understand a lot, but you can still feel incredibly lonely and not have any energy.
Yeah, so one of the lovely things for me was coming to the centre and then seeing all these, you know, I thought, wow, there's all these good people. That was the sort of life I'd led before that. I was, you know, I didn't come across very many good people. But here they all were, all trying to do good. It was like really surprising, you know. It was like, wow, no one here is out to harm me. But these people care about me and my partner, especially with his mother. And then so many students, many of the students would come to my place to look after Tash while I would come to the centre. And then we got married at the centre. So a lot of kindness was extended to me by going along to a Buddhist centre and being in the company of other Buddhists and being able to talk to Miffy's mother for hours and hours and hours on all sorts of days of the week. I'll often be there talking to her about the Buddha Dharma. And of course it was her assistance that led me to meet Geshe Tashi Seren, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, and all the other teachers that I came across. It was really helpful to have a Dharma friend. Good friend, for sure. So you need a good friend, and of course we want, you know, not just like a pal to hang out with and talk about the Dharma. We want someone like seriously involved and along the path, much further along the path than we are. That person is often given the name of spiritual friend, but they're also given the name guru and lama. So the guru, the meaning of this word is heavy. Guru is a root, heavy with good qualities and spiritual presence. So the word guru is short for guna, or good qualities, and ru means collection of. A person with a collection of heavy, good qualities. And lama means somebody who's given birth to the mind of enlightenment. I think the ma is for like mother. and La is mind of enlightenment. The Lama is the person who's given birth to the mind of enlightenment. That's an excellent sort of person to rely upon. And so when we find this teacher, well, when I found my teacher, I didn't know at the time, but I took His Holiness's advice. So he gave this advice I took literally. He said, when you first come across the Buddha Dharma, take 5 years before you decide to adopt. If you want to become a Buddhist, take 5 years of studying, reading, going along, listening, just listening. As it suits you, take it. So within three, of course, I made my mind up. I go, no, this is it for me. Then you read about this reliance upon the teacher. And because of my background and the history of the teachers that had come over from Asia and how the Westerners were basically misunderstood, got done in a lot of them. So they had bad experiences with teachers, and I went, well, that's not going to happen to me. Again, you find in the text, take 11 years, if necessary. Take a long time. The time is to take your time, watch the teacher, keep your eyes on them, and keep an eye on the students. But again, within a pretty quick look at these people, they've certainly got the knowledge, they've certainly got the intellectual capacity. But what you also want to have is a sense of warmth towards them. You know? So, because it's not enough to have a teacher. You have to have a relationship with the teacher. And I always remember that conservatory, I always saying that too. It's not you rely upon a teacher, you'll be right. He said, no, he says you've got to create a relationship with the teacher. And that will only work if you feel warmly towards them. So they have more than just the knowledge. So I found a teacher incredibly knowledgeable, and I went, I think, I'm listening to him, I've taken refuge from him. I took other initiations. But all the time I kept thinking, there's something wrong here. And it's not from him, it's from me. And I couldn't work out what it was. Right? And I found out in the text, when I'm going through the text reading, it said, consider the kindness of the Lama. And that's what I hadn't done. As soon as I did that, then the relationship didn't change. So, you don't want to have that sort of thing where you stand back too long, just investigating, and go, yeah, the knowledge is tremendous. Because just there you can have fear too, because you don't want to be wrong, or you're not quite sure what they'll say, and stuff, so you can become a bit standoffish. That's not a relationship, is it? So you've got to check the teacher.
Also, the kindness of the Lama is that they, just like the Buddha, they see all your faults and they don't judge you. They still care about you. And we forget that. We don't actually kind of tap into that kindness that is there.
And, one of the things that helped me was thinking, no matter how kind my parents were to me, they never, ever explained reality. And I was always looking for the truth, and they could never explain the truth to me. And that's all I really wanted to learn, just tell me the truth. And they couldn't do it, of course. But when I come to the Buddha now, it's like a long life. It's like this. But then everything becomes workable for me. So one of the things we need to do is to consider the necessity of seeing the teacher as a Buddha. And I love what Lama Zopa Rinpoche says. He says, look, we want a profit, not a loss. That's how we are, right? He says, why should we regard our guru as a Buddha? Basically, because we, the disciples, want profit and don't want loss. That's the bottom line. We're doing it for our own sake, for our own mental development. There's no great advantage to the guru in the disciple looking at him as a Buddha. It doesn't make the guru become a Buddha. He says, no matter how many quotations and lines of reasoning we use, this is the conclusion. as to why we should look at our guru as a Buddha. We want profit. We don't want loss. So we want a profit, not a loss. Having the thought that the guru is an ordinary person will cause us to lose realizations or not even gain them. And it's just like you're talking to your mates, isn't it? They say something that's useful, but yeah, must be mate. Not a big deal. But imagine if you actually thought or said that the person you're in front of is an enlightened being. Like, I'm sure, you know, if we wanted to know something and His Holiness the Dalai Lama was here, we could have an interview with him and ask him and tell him, this is the problem, this is what I'm trying to do. Could you help me? I mean, it's possible we could go, thank you, and then don't do anything about it. I mean, that's possible.
Well, seeing His Holiness as an ordinary
being, that's
being would be like thinking, oh, well, you know, he's a bloke and he's Tibetan, what does he know?
Yeah, and he's a monk.
And he's a monk, what does he know?
Yeah, yeah, that's
which
right.
Some people
do.
Lots do.
People
and
do.
So then they don't get any benefit.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and the Chinese look at him as a monk, a wolf in a monk's cloak, misleading everybody. And so what sort of benefit? Well, you don't get any benefit from that, do you? You just have suspicion towards him. If you see him as an ordinary person, what do you get? Well, nothing really, just an ordinary bloke you might think is a nice guy. Doesn't impact you much. But so the more high you can put them on the string and think, oh, from my side, it doesn't, like I say, it doesn't mean he is. But it means that if you see him that way, you benefit in huge life. And that's why I'm saying you want a profit, don't you? You know, there's a lot to be said about this particular topic because it's been misunderstood and applied in such ways that the practitioners have brought great suffering upon themselves. They haven't seen it properly.
Eddie, last time I was over, Rinpoche was here, and so me and the then director had an interview, and so we were invited to lunch. And so over the lunch, I didn't hardly eat anything. I just had my whole list of things to tell Rinpoche about and how Lungri Champa Centre is going and everything. And then on the way after the lunch back down the hill, and the director said, oh, wasn't it a great lunch? I'm like, yeah, it was fantastic. We had this great conversation, got all this advice from Rinpoche. And the director said, oh, no, it was so delicious. Like, the dal was fantastic and the rotis were... Yeah. And I'm like, what? Was that what you were concentrating on? Wasn't an ordinary lunch either. Nothing's ordinary with a guru. And if you just think you're going to lunch with a guru because lunch is delicious,
yeah.
6 years later and you get another chance, maybe.
So the benefits of seeing the guru as the Buddha, is this recognition drives your inner development with a lot of energy and power. Again, from Lama Zopa Rinpoche, he says, the fundamental reason that we need to look at our guru as a Buddha relates to the purpose of our life, which is to benefit other sentient beings. Benefiting other sentient beings doesn't mean bringing them just the happiness of this life by giving them money, food, shelter or medicine, right? It means bringing other sentient beings the happiness of all their coming future lives and the ultimate happiness of liberation and enlightenment. So what really adds to this energy is the recollection of death and impermanence. So there are many benefits of doing this. So here are the six. Your actions become very beneficial. Your Dharma practice becomes most powerful. It's very important to do this at the very beginning of your practice so you don't make the practice about having a good lunch. It's not aimed at this life, right? It's aimed at future lives. So imagine being there with Lama Zopa and your concern is about your future life, right? That's much better than how nice the dal tastes. It's always important in the middle of your practice and it's very important at the end. Why? Because you die content.
Well, it just hit me also when you said about Tash, that if Tash didn't have an impending death, then you wouldn't have made the connection with Lumbree Tompa Centre. Mm. Would have just been a nice to have later.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. It was because her death was sudden, and Martin said, "Well, then, so." Markinson was like, I've got this girl I love. It's like, so what can I do? What's the best thing I can do knowing you're going to die? And my answer to myself is, help you die. Because I can't stop that. But what I could do is decrease as much suffering as possible and make it a really, let you go out without any regrets and you're fine to leave. So that was my goal. But that's how I come to the Buddha Dhamma, just having that goal and suddenly reading the book. Have live and die and go, wow, this is it. They do it. And then, like I said, within a fortnight, meeting a Buddhist monk and coming to the centre. So I've often read about that. Once you sort of, decide what's right for you, all the obstacles just fall away. It's like, there you go.
And also the difference between just having a book and then meeting an actual practitioner makes a big difference too, Buddhist monk.
Yeah, so it's great. So when Pende came to our place and had a chat about why we were interested in this, and it became really obvious because Tash is right there dying, and I'm really concerned about her death. He's got, you're right. I'll come and take you to the centre. And he took us up with Chinna Zigi to see the centre. So, to support this, so you recollect the benefits of it. So we go, okay, well, that's why I'm going to do it. So how do we start to use this recollection so that our practice does become powerful? Well, we recollect that death is certain. So there's no avoiding death. The Lord of Death takes everyone. The lifetime can't be extended, but it's continually diminishing. And while you are alive, there is very little time for practice. So you need to practice Dharma. You definitely have to. Now, the time of this death, of course, is uncertain. Because the lifespan of beings in this world is uncertain. The causes of death are very, very many, while the causes for maintaining the life are very few, and they can kill you too. And our body is very fragile. So what's happening means you've got to practice it right now, practice Dhamma right now. You don't know where you're going to go. Wasn't a Buddhist story, it was I think from the Muslim faith. So this fellow had this, he had a dream or a vision of some sort where death said, I'm going to come for you in this place here. Right, so the bloke said, right, I'm going to make sure I avoid that place. So he went to this other place, and that's where death met him. He says, oh, I was on the way to meet you there, but I see you're here. I'll take you now. And at that time, of course, only your practice will help, nothing else will. Your friends will do their best to help you, but they're unable to. Their help is very, very limited. As you'll discover, if you try to help somebody to die, there's very little you can't stop it happening. All the resources that you have, no matter how many books, money, whatever, it's not going to stop. And of course, the person who's dying, their bodies are not helping them here. Their body's actually letting them down. And you think of how long you've cared for your body, and now it just abandons you. So the practice that you want to engage in there is you want to make sure that it's pure, meaning it's aimed beyond this life. That's what makes practice pure. So what you want to remember then is this, what they call the mindfulness to develop after this, these 9 points. So, and this is one to remember, because I remember a young man, so he used to come to the centre a lot, and he's now a monk. So he was seriously engaged in the study of Buddha Dharma, because he was going to become a monk. He really was. It was taking him years to get there, but he knew he had to get all these things sorted out. He was going to become ordained, and he did. But on the way, this is the part he forgot. If you don't remember this, recollecting death and appearance can be very depressing. The whole point of it all is so that you don't create any causes for suffering in your future at the time of death. That's the whole point. And one of the greatest ways you can create suffering for yourself at the time of death is clutch to this life, hang on to this life, as many people do. They don't want to die. So then they create huge suffering for themselves right now and for their future. So you'll learn as much as you can to let go, let go, let go. Not just let go, but offer. There's all these wonderful practices you can do, and there's a wonderful practice offering the elements of the body at the time of death. It's tremendous. You lie in bed and practice that, and that's a tremendous thing you can do. Or, you know, once again, recollect the face of your guru, or recollect any type of virtue, and aim at it, you know, beyond this life. Okay, so before I go to the next, I'll do it now, that's fine, it's okay. So knowing all this, right, especially like I said, at the time of death, right, we want to have a refuge from future sufferings. We want to die easy, with a sense of contentment, and we've lived meaningful, useful lives here, and there's no problem about leaving it. Because we don't have fear. So you want to have lots of fear if you don't know what to do, or if you think you're panic, or anything like that, right? You want to be scared now.
Or you just don't want it to happen. You're just like, no!
Yeah, that's no good either, right? So get scared now so you're not scared then. That's what all this is about, right? And you won't be scared then because you have a refuge. And the refuge is your own mind. That's the only refuge you'll have left at the time of death, right? So what are you going to do with your mind? And you know the mind is the creator of suffering or happiness. You want to try and create happiness, don't you, right? An easy way of leaving. A sense of leaving everybody out of ease, right? So I remember when Satash was dying and we had one of the students come. And well, the last thing she said to Tash was, see ya. And Tash said to her,
No, she said, I don't think I'll be, this may be the very last time I'm seeing you again. I probably won't see you again.
Yep. And so Tash said, where are you going? The crap. Yeah. I remember this lovely story, you know, one of the great things with the master, you know, he said, you know, we don't go anywhere. We don't come from where you don't go anywhere. Well, that's right. You think about this continuum of mind, which has always existed. And you know, we're just an eye imputed to it. So you have to accept. A smart move is accept the Buddha, which is, like I said, your own mind, your own potential of mind to awaken, plus of all the other people who have awoken, and go, this is my support. I'm not alone here, I don't need to be afraid, I've got the support of all the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, and I've got the nature of Buddha myself. And, you know, I'm fine.
Can you read that out?
So you accept the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha as the safest direction to go to be freed from the sufferings and obscurations. I said, so you know, when Mother Ishi says we should understand that refuge is a state of mind. In brief, it means you die with a mind of virtue. That's refuge. If you cannot die with a virtuous mind, you don't have refuge. But any virtuous mind is your refuge. So, what do you think the measure of having gone for refuge is? Have a guess. Anyone online? Like to have a guess?
The virtue.
The measure of having gone for refuge.
You start to change your behaviour into a more kind and positive.
Oh, that's very good, very close.
You are working not just for this life, but for future lives.
That's very close too, that's very good.
For all sentient.
For all sentient beings.
Yeah, that's another one, that does it too. So all of these are the reversal of ordinary concerns.
That's quite radical.
No, yeah. That's why I put it up there. That's it, wow. Yeah.
So is that like the proof of the pudding, that if you notice you have reversed some of your ordinary concerns, that's a good sign?
That's a good sign, yeah.
And it can give you confidence.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. You're on your way of being a refugee.
It's like how I'm less upset now when things go broke.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. That's a good example, Ian. Yeah. So Geshe Sofa says, your practice should be based on a recollection of death and an awareness of the misery you will experience if you have not prepared properly for this inevitable event. Contemplating this, thinking about it, you should produce an attitude that reverses ordinary concerns. By decisively turning away from the affairs of this life and aspiring to happy rebirths in the future, liberation or enlightenment. The method of avoiding bad rebirths and obtaining good ones is taking refuge in the three jewels and gaining certainty about the cause and effect of karma. So these are the practices of the being of small scope. If you engage in these trainings, you will be able to secure a higher rebirth in your next life. The gaining certainty about cause and effect of karma is this virtue, right? You know, what produces virtue, what produces non-virtue. Avoid what produces non-virtue, do what produces virtue. Well, this is the essential thing of when you take refuge, you start acting in accordance with Buddha's teachings of karma, cause and effect. And you like turn away from the concerns of this life.
So would another measure be not being frightened of death?
Yeah, but the Lama said, like, why are you not frightened of death?
Because you have refuge and...
Yeah, as you might say, yeah, but yeah. There's nothing after it, mate, I'm not frightened. Mm. That's the end. You might be mistaken. Yeah, you know, some of these stories of different Christian people have passed away, and they are quite happy to leave because they go to meet Christ or they go to heaven. So they're not concerned about the world anymore. Yeah? They've got these other goals and they're on their way. You know, or sometimes they say, yeah, I'm going to meet Auntie such and such and I'll be with my family in heaven. So you say they don't have the concerns about staying here because someone's got a problem or I could do this or what would happen if, you know. So they have a refuge too. It's just a different one than ours.
So when you said that our refuge is our mind, what if we die and we've got dementia? Then, like, the nature of our mind is still clear, but we can't necessarily access that with dementia.
No, but, so one of the things with dementia is that you really don't have control over your mind. I mean, the mind is just running itself, isn't it? So anyway, so there's not a lot of strength of karma in that, because karma requires intention, right? Deliberate intention. Otherwise, you've just got the normal intention. So this is what I remember one of the other lamas saying, yeah, don't worry about that. And I remember another one too, of a guy who got dementia, and what was really interesting, when he finally died, he was quite calm. So I said, yeah, all those years of practice. And like he couldn't, and it was a sort of a gentleness about him. One of my mate's mother passed away on the weekend, and she was this really soft, kind person that I knew. And then, you know, they told me, yeah, she'd be like 5 or 6 years of dementia in the old age home, and they're quite, it's like, thank God all that suffering's over. You know, I think I was like, yeah, but it's like, once again, all that stuff's adventitious. It's just coming and going, and you've got no control over it.
Like with Inter, when she was dying, she had brain tumours, so her behaviour got all erratic. But it's more like, you know, you when the doctor hits your knee and your leg flips up, and it's just
a reflex.
That's right. So it's just like a brain reflex. It wasn't actually any deep karma happening with that. And in the death process, once the death process started, then all of that fell away.
Yeah, which it does. And very much like when Cheryl passed away too, wasn't it? It's quite difficult for her, but she had a stroke. But just before passing, it was like all the calmness came. It's like, yep, that stuff's just on the surface. Falls away. What's important for us, if we die without dementia, the most important thing is to, like I said, deliberately think something with motivation. So we deliberately remember the Lama. We remember the mind of the Lama, that we are dying with this intention to become awakened for the benefit of others. Yeah, so you tell yourself that. Yeah. I think the great thing about dying, there's no escape. Yeah. So you behave the best you can. Why would you want to behave badly? That's going to be the way out. Go, oh, see ya. I'll just do this crazy, stupid thing. I'll leave you with that memory. That doesn't help us, doesn't help anybody else.
So don't die like the Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah, that's right. Don't die like that. So, okay. That's our last slide. Is there anything you'd like to say online before we sort of finish up?
No, just mentioning that Francisca also was around at that time when Tash were, and met Eddie and Tash through Pende and developed a strong friendship very quickly.
So we now have these four preliminary reflections. So everybody, what was the first one? Anybody remember?
We have Buddha Nature.
Thank you, Ian. Buddha Nature. That's right. And what comes after Buddha Nature? Don't look down at your notes.
Perfect human rebirth.
And what comes after that?
Recollection of death.
No.
Precious teacher.
Precious teacher, that's right. So we need a teacher to help us, introduce us to the teacher, to show us how to die well, so we can engage in this practice with our mind aware and keep on this path. Because, I think knowledge of death is a great time to be really honest, you know. We would try to be honest as possible as you can as you live your life, but there's no point in misleading yourself at that time or anyone else, really.
And, you know, like people talk about their bucket list, so our bucket list should really be filled with Buddha Dharma. And we should be actioning our bucket list right now.
So again, so Geshe Toshi Sering says, the virtuous, positive states of mind are what really afford us refuge. And this is, again, from Lama Yeshe. Refuge is a state of mind. And a virtuous state of mind, a mind that's turned away from the concerns of this life, is a virtuous mind. They protect the mind. And in the end, it is our mind that we need to protect. What's the measure of refuge?
The reversal of ordinary concerns. I cheated them. The reversal of ordinary concerns.
Trading words, you're going to trade it. Get that slogan down there. That's right, and if we at all possibly can organise it, so if we have the leisure to die at home in bed, surrounded by friends and family, Don't let them talk about lunch.
No.
Have them talk about the Buddha Dharma.
In fact, we were looking after Biffy's mum when she was passing away. It was great because we were able to do her sadhanas for her, you know. So she'd give us her practices and then we'd read them all out. It was really nice being able to sort of pause here and there. And
yeah, share them.
Yeah, share the thing, you know, together. I mean, that's what she did when Tash died for me, you know. If his mum come, it was like, you know, I've never had anybody die on me, let alone my wife before. So it's like, I could do with some, I didn't even have to ask her. She says, come on, let's go. We got a taxi from their place, got up to my place. Tash was there, corpse on the bed, put out the mandala, sat around and had some music practice. But she led me all through it, you know. It was just like, I can barely do this thing. It was great. You've got somebody there, do this now, do that. Yeah, it's tremendous. So, pages 1 to 7, and any of the refuge meditations do that. There are some excerpts from the Lamam Chenma. I think there's more meditations there. Have a look at those. And we come back in a fortnight, or 3 weeks later.
So we have 2 weeks of puja. So we've got Tara Puja and then Medicine Buddha Puja, in which there is refuge practices. Mm-hmm. And then after that is the review.
Yeah.
And of course, on is the 16th of April is the refuge ceremony with Geshe Saltram. So that's a Sunday. And so everyone's welcome to come to that, whether you're actually taking the vows or you just want to listen, or you've already taken refuge and you want to top up, everybody's welcome to that one.
In fact, I remember one of our students here. So she grew up a Christian all of her life. She'd been teaching in Catholic schools. And she came here and the Lama was Chogyam Rinpoche. So he gave this teaching and she ended up taking refuge. And then took the Medicine Buddha initiation. It's like I was sort of thinking something like that might happen. So you can come along and, like I say, take refuge or just.
So family members who aren't taking refuge but want to come and, you know, it's a special event, are most welcome.
So we put some effort into this. That means we've created some merit. We don't want the merit to go to the concerns of just this life, do we? We want to go beyond that, we're going to take it to future high rigors, liberation and enlightenment, wherever it might be, we're going towards some goal beyond ourselves, and be it for the benefit of others. So due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the Supreme Jewel, Bodhicitta, not yet born, arise from birth. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. And as long as space endures, as long as sentient beings abide, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. So thank you, everybody. Thank you to the people here and those online. And take refuge.